Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers. This is episode 75, Categorical Probability Theory and the Measurement Problem, with Nicormod and V. Velocini. He is at the University of Oxford, and Velocini is at ETH Zurich. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/75. Show notes include Nick and Velocity's paper, so you can read along, as well as some other papers and links to related episodes of Physics Frontiers. And now my conversation with Nick and Velocity.
Hey, Velocity. Hey, Nick. How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. So, you know, I've been reading this paper that you've got here, Which Theories Have a Measurement Problem? Okay, and I found this interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it's going through and trying to figure out, again, which theories have a measurement problem. And it's using categorical probability theory. And categorical probability theory is something I had not heard of. I'd heard of category theory and hadn't really gotten into it very much, but I think it's something interesting. It's something that people are using a lot for a lot of different things. And I assume this categorical probability theory is not just being used for quantum mechanics. It's being used for statistical mechanics. I've seen some places where that's happening as well. And now it makes some lectures I've seen make a little more sense. Why are they drawing all these little lines all over the place on the slides? Now I understand why they're drawing all the lines all over the place. I'd like to talk about both of these. I'd like to talk about the measurement problem a little bit. I'd like to talk about your no-go theorem, and I would like to talk about categorical probability theory and how it helps you investigate this. So I would like to start, because there's often a little bit of a problem with understanding the measurement problem itself. Sometimes people don't mean quite the same thing. What exactly do you mean by the measurement problem?
Yeah, so in fact, the measurement problem really isn't one single problem. It's actually a cluster of related problems. And our paper is certainly not addressing all versions of that problem. In particular, actually, traditionally, when the measurement problem has been formulated, it's often been formulated in a way that really essentially relies on the native language of quantum theory. You know, people talk about the measurement problem being that if the world is described by a quantum state and it evolves unitarily, then it seems like we shouldn't get unique outcomes. That's quite a theory-dependent formulation of the measurement problem. But a development that's happened, I suppose, more recently in the foundations of quantum physics is people have found a pretty nice way of formulating the measurement problem in a theory-independent way. So kind of similarly to how once upon a time our discussion of quantum non-locality was very much based directly on the quantum formalism, as in the EPR paper, for example. But then we had John Bell came along and he found a way of making it, of articulating the problem independently of the language of quantum theory. Now, much more recently, people have come along and they found a way of articulating the measurement problem in a theory independent way. But it is, of course, yeah, as I said, the measurement problem is really a cluster of related problems. People have found one particular way of articulating one particular aspect of the problem. And it's based on this idea that observed events, things that happen that we can see, right? Observed events might fail to be absolute. So what does it mean for something to be absolute? It means that it's unique and it's non-relational. So, for example, well, it's probably easier to get a sense of how observed events might fail to be absolute, right? So if I do some kind of measurement and the outcome of that measurement is either that a light bulb flashes, or the light bulb doesn't flash, it stays dim, then intuitively we would think that only one of these happens. But if you believe in the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, then you actually think that both things happen. You think that there are two worlds and they're equally real, and relative to one of those worlds, the light bulb flashes, but relative to the other one, the light bulb stays dim. And so it's not an absolute fact that the light bulb flashes. It's only a fact relative to a particular world or a particular branch. And there are other ways that you could go about denying the absoluteness of observed events. But in general, it's just the assumption that, you know, when you see the light bulb flashing, that just means that there's this single, unconditional, definite fact of the matter, that you saw that and you didn't see anything else. And that's all there is to say on the matter.
Okay, so the way I'm getting this is that you're saying that the way you're looking at things is you're denying that in some way. Is that what you're saying?
No, just to add to your very nice summary, right? So I believe what Nick is saying is that this non-absoluteness of events that he just described can be seen as a manifestation, one particular version of the measurement problem. And in a sense, even the traditional way of thinking of the measurement problem in this sort of quantum theory dependent language is really at the tension between two kinds of dynamics or evolution that quantum mechanics seems to, at least the postulates of the theory, give you. One is unitary evolution, which is how we describe closed quantum systems. This is reversible. And on the other hand, there is a projection postulate, which says that, okay, when you measure something and observe an outcome, somehow the state updates or quote unquote collapses to some particular outcome. And this is irreversible. And somehow there is this tension between these two things. And this sort of this idea of non-absoluteness of events that Nick described right now can be seen as a concrete way in which to sort of place this kind of tension between these two evolutions. Because on the one hand, if things evolve unitarily, then you start off with some kind of a superposition state, then you end up with a superposition of an observer observing one outcome, like say, as you said, the light is dim and the other light, you know, being bright. And then one could not assign a definite fact of the matter as to whether the light was dim or whether the light was bright in this view of the world if we describe everything unitarily. On the other hand, this seems to conflict with our direct experience of observing exactly one outcome. So somehow this absolute non-absoluteness of events is sort of a way to characterize the measurement problem that's kind of inspired by this kind of attention, but one can try to formulate it in a more theory independent way.
Okay, and is that where the categorical probability theory comes in? Is you're trying to do it in a more theory independent way? Because I know that's what category theory is all about, is trying to take a bunch of different things that have the same structure and put them together.
Exactly. So the intuition would be that this sort of a tension between these two evolutions that you have in the quantum case, one can ask, what is the corresponding version of these two evolutions in a more general theory that has some natural structure, like where you can draw circuit diagrams and so on? So what is the analog of the perspective of, you know, someone who measures and sees a definite outcome, as opposed to a view that corresponds to describing a whole measurement as the evolution of a closed system, and what is the dynamics of that? So indeed, that, as you correctly noted, this going to these categorical probabilistic theories gives a way to formulate this whole idea of having these two kind of dynamics and having a tension between them in a theory independent way by looking at how can we describe these dynamics under some minimal axioms without assuming the Hilbert space and a unitary structure.
So we're getting rid of, why don't we just talk about this in terms of categorical probability theory? Mm-hmm. So how does that actually work? How does the categorical probability theory actually work? What's going on when you're drawing these little diagrams? Maybe explain that you draw diagrams.
The idea of category theory in general is to study a theory based on the structure of its transformations. And the idea is that in reasonable physical theories, you should be able to combine different transformations in various ways. So, for example, suppose that it's possible that I can perform some kind of transformation on a system. Like an example would be in quantum theory, I can apply some unitary transformation to some system. Suppose that I could apply one transformation T to a system, but I could also apply a different transformation G to that same system. A core idea of category theory is that, of course, if I can do the transformation T and I can also do the transformation G, then I should be able to do T and then G, right? If I can do the two transformations individually, I should be able to do them one after the other. It's kind of plausible that this is something that should be possible in any theory in which the two transformations are individually possible. And then you can also say other similar things, like if I can do one transformation over here in this bit of space and another transformation over there in that bit of space, then it seems like I should be able to do both of them at the same time. And so there should be a third transformation that lives in my theory that just corresponds to doing those two transformations at the same time. And if you believe in both of those things and sort of you specify what you mean by those things in a precise and natural way, then that can get you all the way to something called a symmetric monoidal category. It's basically a theory in which you've got some kind of set of transformations and they can be combined. They can be combined in those two ways. And we can formulate quantum theory in such a way that it forms a symmetric monoidal category, as we can with classical theories, because they obey these basic constraints. And so you might say that any reasonable physical theory should satisfy these constraints, but you might also say that that's not quite enough, because if we think about quantum theory, for example, often when people think about quantum theory, they just think about Hilbert spaces and vectors on Hilbert spaces and unitary linear maps that are transforming those vectors on the Hilbert spaces. But in a sense, that's not all that quantum theory is about, right? Because at some point when we do quantum theory, we get probability distributions. And probability distributions, they're not defined in terms of Hilbert spaces. The probability distributions are not probability distributions over vectors, for example. The probability distributions are distributions over classical variables that describe the outcomes of measurement. And that's important, you know, because quantum theory is an empirical theory of physics. And so one of its foremost jobs is to provide predictions for outcomes of experiments that we typically describe using classical variables. And so we should, and indeed we can, be able to formulate quantum theory in such a way where we explicitly include this part of the theory that deals with those predictions for measurement outcomes. And that bit of the theory, that sort of sub part of the theory that deals with the classical predictions, that is a classical sub theory of quantum theory, if you like, or at least we can formulate it in that way. We can formulate quantum theory in such a way where a part of the theory, an actual intrinsic part of the theory, is the way that it gives you predictions for outcomes described by classical variables. And anyway, the idea of a categorical probabilistic theory is essentially to have a symmetric monodal category, which might not be completely classical, but it should at least include this sort of classical sub-theory that allows you to make predictions, so that your symmetric monodal category is not just some abstract theory, rather it's something that's actually enabling you to make concrete predictions for measurement outcomes.
And if I could add, so when you say symmetric monodal category, you can think of this as any theory where you can draw circuit diagrams. Maybe that's a good intuition to have in mind. And then this probabilistic part tells you that's any theory with circuit diagrams where you have a well-defined way of extracting probabilities and making predictions about the world using those circuit diagrams.
This is actually quite interesting. So let's pretend I was reading, say, Tim Maudlin or something like that a second ago this morning with my coffee. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me that we have five different kinds of interpretations of quantum mechanics. You were talking earlier about something a little bit like making a many worlds interpretation. But when I'm hearing you talk about the categorical probability theory, and this is, you know, on the third reading, it becomes fairly obvious that you're also dealing with something that feels at least a little bit like collapse, right? Because, you know, you'll have these wires. These wires, if they're solid, they're basically wave functions, is the way I'm interpreting them. Maybe that's not the right way to interpret them. You can tell me if that's true, but the wires seem to be the quantum mechanical state of the system. And then you'll have these little boxes that look like devices. And those are basically operators or measurements. I'd normally think of them as a measurement. And then out of those things could come another wire, another solid wire, or a little dashed wire. A little dashed wire, you're telling me, is a classical system, right? Mm-hmm. And so I guess this seems to me like you have two competing interpretations operating at the same time. Am I missing something, or what's going on? Why is this not two different interpretations going on at the same time?
So I agree that when you're using this kind of framework in which you can always go back and forth between describing everything unitarily versus describing certain things as giving you these classical outcomes, it feels like a sort of collapse. But I think it's important to distinguish between a objective collapse, which is what you get in the GRW interpretation of quantum theory, where the wave function is a real thing and it really collapses and there's actual physical dynamical laws that tell you when it's going to collapse. So that's objective collapses. It's important to distinguish them from what we might call subjective collapses or relative collapses. And I would say that only certain interpretations of quantum theory are objective collapse theories. But there's a sense in which any interpretation of quantum theory has to be at least a subjective or a relative collapse theory. Because even if you're an Everettian, right, you don't want to deny that it appears as if the wave function is collapsing. You don't want to deny that it appears as if you're getting this unique classical outcome. Otherwise, your theory wouldn't be reproducing what you experienced. And it's the same thing in Bohm theory. In Bohm theory, the wave function never really collapses, but Bohm theorists talk about an effective collapse of the wave function because you can effectively sort of ignore some parts of the wave function once you realize that the Bohmian particles don't live on that bit. And so when we're using this kind of framework in which we assume that, yeah, we can always move back and forth between these more general descriptions and these descriptions when we get classical outcomes, I don't think we're assuming a particular interpretation of quantum theory. Rather, we're just assuming that we've got some kind of interpretation of quantum theory that actually allows you to recover its empirical content.
I could add to that. So what you were sort of calling two perhaps interpretations in this scenario, indeed, they're not necessarily interpretations, but they're a bit analogous to how, as I mentioned before, in the quantum case, we have two kinds of competing dynamics. One is sort of unitary evolution. And if you sort of evolve everything unitarily, you would map quantum systems to quantum systems or superpositions to superpositions in general, and not associate with this evolution some kind of classical outcomes, classical records. But on the other hand, once we start trying to extract probabilities through the bond rule, for instance, which is also something quantum theory gives us independently of how we interpret it, then we have to start assigning, you know, say projectors or some, you know, measurement operators, and then associate this with classical outcomes that we observe. And so somehow what we have here now in these categorical probabilistic theories is sort of an analog of these two competing kind of evolutions that you have in quantum theory. It's a bit between, like, say, unitary dynamics and the bond rule. You know, the bond rule allows us to extract probabilities over classical variables in some sense, while unitary evolution doesn't talk about classical variables at all. Yeah, so in a sense, we can use quantum theory, the unitary postulate and the bond rule, independently of the interpretation of quantum theory that we talk about. So in the same way, one can use our framework independently of the interpretation. And also, as we're thinking of these wires as, say, wave functions, you could think of this, of course, in the particular case of a categorical probabilistic theory, which is quantum theory, then you can interpret these wires as curves, you know, telling you something about the state of the system and the operations as being measurements or unitaries. But more generally, we want to model theories that are not just quantum, but, you know, any theory where you can draw these kind of circuit diagrams. So the wires could be any state in that theory of some system, which need not be described by wave functions or Hilbert spaces and so on. It could have any other description, but just that there's a well-defined notion of state and well-defined notion of transformations that satisfy the natural properties that Nick explained before. So then in that sense, it doesn't necessarily need to be interpreted as a wave function. But of course, in the case of quantum theory, you can think of it that way.
Yeah, indeed. And it might be worth actually as well at this stage explicitly pointing out the ways that one can use our framework in order to describe different interpretations of quantum theory, even if you are just doing quantum theory. So by way of example, we've sort of been talking about this particular case of unitary quantum theory, where we've got this very strange thing called the Heisenberg cut, which enables us to sort of move back and forth between these two very different descriptions of what is physically the same thing, the same measurement. So the idea is that on the one hand, we could be describing a measurement as giving you some outcome with a given probability distribution, in which case it seems like there is an outcome. It seems like there is a unique outcome, at least intuitively. But then in unitary quantum theory, we can move away from that and we can think of ourselves as being on the outside of this measurement, as it were. And we can think about that whole measurement as just being a unitary evolution, just like how all evolutions of closed systems in unitary quantum theory are unitary. So with the Heisenberg cut of quantum theory, we move back and forth between thinking of the same measurement as being a unitary evolution and as giving us some outcome, some classical outcome with a given probability. And the point of the framework of our use of categorical probabilistic theories, and in particular the way that we added to them to create this framework that we called perspectival theories, is to just basically give the categorical probabilistic theories a little bit of extra structure that is going to allow us to, it's going to permit those categorical probabilistic theories to have some kind of analog to this Heisenberg cut, but crucially without actually forcing them to do so. So the idea is that generally with categorical probabilistic theory, whether it's quantum or non-quantum, we can have this sort of representation of a measurement that you sort of mentioned earlier, James, where you've got this solid wire going into the box, which means you have this possibly non-classical system that's getting measured. And then you've got this dashed wire coming out, which means you've got this classical outcome and these probabilities for it. That's one representation of a measurement, which we call a probability extractor, because it's sort of, it is extracting probabilities from the system. But the idea of this framework of perspectival theories that we introduced is within your categorical probabilistic theory, there's always another transformation corresponding to that probability extractor that's called a memory update. And it can be that the memory update looks very different to the probability extractor. So it can be that the memory update is something like a unitary evolution, right? In which case we would be reconstructing this sort of unitary version of quantum theory within our framework. But you could also make a different choice for what you think the memory update is. So if you are an objective collapse theorist, if you think that the collapses are not just subjective or relative or illusory, if you think that the wave function is real and it really collapses, then when you're formulating your theory in our framework, your memory update is going to look a hell of a lot like the probability extractor, because both of these evolutions are going to be probabilistic. And yeah, they're not quite mathematically going to be exactly the same kind of object, but basically they're telling the same story. And so it's not that all of the theories in our framework have this really weird thing where you've got two very different representations of the same measurement. The point is rather just to incorporate those theories. And so it's to have a general framework of theories that may or may not have this kind of peculiar feature from unitary quantum theory.
Do you think you could talk a little bit more about what this perspectival theory is and why it is, what it means?
I could start by just putting what Nick said in terms of a more concrete example that we can kind of refer to. So this comes from, say, like it goes back to Wigner in 1967, who was kind of considering basically what happens, like, you know, quantum theory is very successful at describing the microscopic world, has been tested, you know, very accurately. And what happens if we try to extend quantum theory to now include observers or agents? And sort of this analogy that Nick was making between the probability extractor and this kind of memory update can be seen concretely in terms of a thought experiment that Wigner first proposed, which is kind of to first, you know, consider a friend of Wigner who measures some quantum state, some superposition, and they see some outcome, either zero or one. And from the perspective of this friend who measures the state, they're going to apply the bond rule to compute the probability, and they can, you know, apply a projector to that state, and, you know, they will somehow see a collapse of the wave function from their perspective, you know, that results in a zero or a one outcome. But on the other hand, now if there's Wigner who's describing the whole lab of the friend as a closed system, then if Wigner believes in quantum theory, they have to describe this whole lab as evolving unitarily. So the final state that Wigner would see is somehow a superposition of the friend obtaining the outcome zero and seeing the outcome zero along with, you know, getting the outcome one and perceiving the outcome one. And so somehow in this sort of example, you can see that the friend's perspective is that of a probability extractor in the language of perspectival theories. And Wigner's perspective, the outside agent's perspective, is that of the memory update. So this is sort of where this term perspectival maybe comes from. That in general, in these scenarios, if you kind of allow quantum theory to be valid, quantum theory or, you know, the more general physical theory to be valid sort of universally, then you could expect scenarios where somehow the perspective of one observer is different from that of another in general. And so, as Nick said, the framework aims to capture these kind of very general scenarios, which is why things can in principle be perspectival. But they don't have to be. Of course, it can also describe theories where all the perspectives are the same, like these objective collapse theories. So that's sort of some context for the term perspectival.
Now, you have a no-go theorem that is similar to Wigner's friend. I would like to get a description of that no-go theorem before we start talking about what it means. So I think we have a good overview of what it's going to mean, but there's a lot of detail in there. So let's just start with the no-go theorem, if you'd like.
Yeah, so I guess we should probably say first that we're not the first people to come up with a no-go theorem for absolute observed events. So there are a number of results in the literature that have come up in the last 5 years or so that have derived the non-absoluteness of observed events by assuming something like unitary quantum theory and maybe some other principles too. So actually a sort of way of putting the point that I find to be particularly nice is you can write down a no-go theorem that assumes that unitary quantum theory is true and universal in the sense that you can always describe isolated systems as evolving unitarily. And you can always use the Born rule to calculate the probabilities for not just individual measurements, but also pairs of measurements taking place at the same time. And now that assumption alone is consistent with the idea that there's a preferred reference frame of the universe. And so the Bohmian is going to get around this theorem by rejecting that principle. But now the second principle that we're going to assume is that relativity theory is true. And so we assume that actually you can use any reference frame in order to judge which pair of measurements take place at the same time. And if you assume both of those things, if you assume the universality of unitary quantum theory, and if you assume the account of simultaneity that we get from relativity theory, then you can actually derive that observed events are not absolute, which is a really big deal, right? Because that means that if you want to maintain the absoluteness of observed events, that means you're going to have to give up either on universal unitary quantum theory or on relativity theory, basically one of our two best physical theories. And yet you might still consider wanting to do that, because rejecting the absoluteness of observed events is, for one thing, it seems very unnatural, it's very counterintuitive, but actually much more importantly than that, it's sort of difficult to make sense even of the idea that a real empirical scientific theory can say that observed events are absolute. At least it's not clear that you can make sense of this, because the predictions that any empirical theory makes are, of course, for the events that we observe. And if we start saying that the events that we observe are not absolute, we don't say that they're unique and non-relational, then it at least introduces the possibility that we're not going to be getting unique and unconditional predictions for those observed events. But if we're not getting unique predictions from a scientific theory, if the same scientific theory is saying that, you know, many different incompatible things are all going to happen, then it's not clear which observations we should take to confirm the theory or which observations we could take to falsify the theory. But if the theory is not confirmable and it's not falsifiable, that's not just a bad empirical theory. That's just not an empirical theory. Yeah, I'm not saying that this is necessarily going to be the case in any theory that rejects absoluteness, but it's at least something that you might and probably should be concerned about. And so you might really want to reject one of unitarity or relativity theory. But that sort of raises the question of what theory might replace unitary quantum theory and or relativity theory, and whether it's at all going to be reasonable. And so basically what we wanted to do with our no-go theorem is sort of explore whether it's actually possible or whether it's credible that one day we're going to come along with some better future theory of physics that actually manages to avoid leading to these kind of no-go theorems, whether in the future we might have a theory of physics that doesn't sort of push us towards the non-absoluteness of observed events in the way that quantum theory and relativity theory do. And so the point of our no-go theorem, as opposed to the previous ones that assumed these two particular theories, unitary quantum theory or relativity theory, or at least assumed unitary quantum theory, depending on the particular no-go theorem, the point of our no-go result was precisely not to assume unitary quantum theory. Instead, we wanted to remain agnostic about what the correct theory is. We wanted to just assume that whatever the correct theory is, it's somehow a reasonable physical theory. And that's where the assumption that it's a categorical probabilistic theory and a perspectival theory comes in. But then we wanted to see if we could show that any reasonable physical theory that respects a certain set of physical principles that one could reasonably hope or expect any future theory of physics to satisfy would inevitably lead to this no-go theorem for absolute observed events. So we wanted to show that any reasonable physical theory that has a certain set of properties inevitably forces you to give up the absoluteness of observed events. And we were able to do this. We wrote down sort of a couple of no-go theorems at different levels of depth. But the first result we had says that any perspectival theory with three properties inevitably is going to be inconsistent with the absoluteness of observed events. And those three properties are, first, Bell non-locality, which just means that the theory says you can violate Bell inequalities at space-like separation. And of course, nobody's going to reject that because we've seen it happen. That's sort of non-negotiable, that one. The second principle is that the theory is information preserving in the sense that when I do a measurement, at least according to the memory update representation of the measurement, I don't destroy any of the system, any of the information that was associated with the system. That information can always be recovered by somebody else in the future, according to information preservation. And then the third and final property was that the dynamics are local, basically meaning that if I think about some kind of dynamical process, some kind of evolution that's taking place across this big extended region of space, then local dynamics is saying that somehow that process decomposes into little processes that correspond to individual smaller regions of space. Saying something like that, the big processes decompose into little processes, or the big dynamics decompose into little dynamics. And so the no-go result is very simple. It's just saying that any perspectival theory that has all of these properties is inconsistent with absoluteness. And so if you are concerned with those problems that I was mentioning about absoluteness, then you know what you need to do. You need to reject one of those properties. But since you can't reject Bell non-locality, you got to either reject information preservation or else you have to reject local dynamics. That's the cost of maintaining that observed events are absolute.
I've got these three things. Bell non-locality. So we're just saying that, you know, these, I'm going to get the initials wrong, this CHSH inequality is violated, right? Mm-hmm. And which it cannot be in a classical theory, right? Which means that something non-classical is going on. The last one is local dynamics. That's the one you're going to break up later on. But I mean, you can think of that. That's the one that's going to preserve relativity by saying that as you're evolving, it's only the things that are nearby that you're looking at. And the information preservation, I don't know, is it possible to talk a little bit more about what you mean by that? I mean, I have a feeling about what it means as far as the evolution of the wave function, but I think it might be a little more abstract than I'd normally think about it.
Well, Villasini was already discussing the Figner's friend scenario earlier, and I guess that's that can be a straightforward example.
Yeah, so maybe just to say a bit more concretely, because indeed, there's first, like, before formulating these perspectival theories, right, or just kind of looking at the Wigner's friend scenario, which is a really quantum specific example, one can already see, as I said before, this sort of tension between these two kind of evolutions, right, which is kind of the measurement problem. And as you said before, the measurement problem is typically something that that's typically only considered within quantum theory. It's considered a pathology that's specific to quantum theory. So if we want to understand how we might formulate the measurement problem in a theory-independent way, we want somehow an analog of these two kind of dynamics, somehow the dynamics to which we extract probabilities, and there's somehow a different picture where we might describe closed systems of the theory. And this is where sort of this information preservation idea comes in. It's supposed to give you an analog of what the unitary evolution does in quantum theory, but in a way that it's formulated as a concept that applies to general physical theories. So this was something this idea of information preservation, something we originally proposed in an earlier paper of mine with Nuria Nurkaliva and Lydia Del Rio. But the idea is basically that, say you have a system that you measure, right? Like, so in this Wigner's friend scenario, there's a quantum system, say S, that the friend of Wigner measures, and then after this, at the end, what you have is some state of the system as well as the rest of the laboratory of this friend. So let's call the rest of the laboratory L, right? So now you have some joint state on L and S. That's what Wigner is going to come and perform his measurement on. And now what we can ask is whether somehow the dynamics that Wigner is going to use to describe the evolution of the system from some state on S to some joint state on S and L, so the whole lab, does this dynamic somehow preserve the information that was originally contained in the state of the system S, right? And in quantum theory, you can see this because, say, your state of the system S was some superposition of, alpha times ket 0 plus beta times ket 1. Then if you evolve everything unitarily, let's say that the friend measures in the computational basis, measures whether it's 0 or 1, then the final state of the lab and the system would be alpha 0,0 plus beta 1,1. So where 0,0 corresponds to the state of the whole lab when the friend observes the outcome 0. And you can see that this somehow preserves information because this is really isomorphic to the original state. So anything, the idea is that any measurement I could do on the original state, alpha 0 plus beta 1 of the system, I can now construct a corresponding measurement I can do on this alpha 0,0 plus beta 1,1. I just need to treat the 0 as now being 0,0, the 1 as being 1,1, such that I could get the same probabilities. So this is the sense in which information is preserved by the unitary dynamics that Wigner uses to describe the friend's evolution. Mm-hmm. But now the way we formulate this in a general theory is precisely the same idea. What we say is that, okay, now the dynamics can be anything. So we call this the memory update, is what would be the outside description of the measurement. And we say that the memory update is information preserving if for any operation I can do on the system alone, before I apply this memory update, I can find a corresponding operation that I can do on the whole lab, or which is the system and the memory of the system and the rest of the lab, that I could do after this memory update, which gives me the same conclusions, or in particular, the same probabilities. And if this is the case, you can say that, okay, this memory update preserves information. Anything I could do before, now I can do after in a way that I can extract the same information. So that's roughly the idea of the information preserving update. It tells you that this description, this memory update is going to preserve the information you had in your initial state. But of course, unitary evolution is a particular example of an information preserving memory update. But one can have, in fact, even in the theory beyond quantum theory, one can define such memory updates. So one can find such examples.
Yeah, and it might be worth sort of trying to address a possible confusion that some people might have about this this quantum Figner's friend example. So it can sound very confusing to people who know a bit about quantum theory, this idea that in any sense we could talk about the measurements being information preserving, because of course one of the first things that you hear about quantum theory is that measurements are disturbing, right? So when you measure the position of a particle, say, you sort of you influence its momentum, you change it, such that if you knew earlier what the momentum was, now you don't know it anymore, right? So there's this idea that actually measurements do destroy information in quantum theory. But the point is that if we take really seriously the idea, as Villicini was in her description of the Figner's friend scenario just now, if we really take seriously the idea that quantum theory actually says that isolated systems always evolve unitarily, then we have to bear in mind that unitary evolutions can always be reversed. And so even if it's true that from the perspective of the friend inside the laboratory, he's no longer able to access, say, the momentum anymore of the particle after he's measured the position, right? Even if it seems to him like information has been destroyed, if we're really serious about the universality of unitary evolution, then it must be the case that Figner outside the lab can still access the momentum of the original particle by just undoing the entire unitary evolution that described the friend's measurement process, and then just getting that particle and measuring its momentum.
Maybe to add to that, to the concrete example again, so imagine I drop this glass of tea in the floor, you know, that we sort of, it would shatter into many pieces, and there's no practical way in which we can sort of reverse it back to, you know, reassemble itself into this mug on my table. But in principle, if you believe in the validity of universal validity of quantum theory, the information about, you know, the state of the mug when everything was put together is there in the environment. It's just very difficult for us to access it. But in principle, an all-powerful agent who had access to all those degrees of freedom could assemble that information back together. So this is the sense in which somehow, even though, you know, to an observer, it could seem as though information is being lost or you can't reverse a process, if you believe somehow that quantum theory or like a more general theory that is information preserving is valid at a more universal level, then in principle, that information is out there in the universe. So that's the sense in which it's information preserving.
Okay, so I always like to think back with these things towards the Sturm-Gerlach experiment, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you take the Sturm-Gerlach experiment, you put the electron beam, you know, through your gradient field, it splits into two. And then if you had an opposite gradient field afterwards, it would come back to being the same beam, basically, when the two beams combined. So at that level, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it just doesn't make sense when you say, okay, well, when I have these split beams, there's some other guy, right, sitting there, you know, in some way recording these things. But I guess he's not really recording individual. Yeah, I'm not sure how to interpret that in terms of that you had somebody who was going through and actually recording it in the middle, and then having a third person. I mean, I know how the Wigner's friend works. It's just that making it make sense is quite difficult. Saying, okay, I've got an electron beam coming in. I split it, make a measurement on the way out. I put them back together somehow. And now this third party, Wigner, is able to measure something. It would be a different measurement than what I saw. in the actual laboratory box. But I mean, obviously it all works out as far as math is concerned and as far as the experiments are concerned too. So it's not a, I'm not completely sure how analogous those experiments are, but they're pretty close. Now, what I think is that we still don't, well, okay, let me ask you, do you think that it is worthwhile going through your particular no-go theorem, or would you just, do you think that's worthwhile? Because when I asked you about it, you went through to talking about the BIL theories, which is fine because that was the next question. But would you like to just give us an overview of that particular no-go theorem, your particular no-go theorem, so that people know what it is? If you don't think that's important, that's fine, because we've got one more level, at least, for this paper.
So the first no-go theorem was just this fact that any BIL theory, that is any theory that's any perspectival theory that's Bell non-local, information preserving, and satisfies local dynamics, is inconsistent with the absoluteness of observed events. So in a slogan, we say all Bell theories has a measurement problem. That was our first no-go result. We did derive a sort of deeper no-go result where we actually derived the L in that. So we derived the local dynamics from deeper assumptions. And that's sort of interesting to talk about because it's something that, as I was sort of mentioning earlier, part of the motivation for this was seeing whether or not there's any reasonable way of recovering the absoluteness of observed events by rejecting unitary quantum theory, or perhaps whether there's a way that's better than the ways of doing that we already know about, like objective collapse theories, which hang on to absoluteness by rejecting information preservation, or like pilot wave theories, which hang on to absoluteness by embracing these superluminal causal influences and hence rejecting local dynamics. There is something interesting about this sort of this deeper version of the no-go result, which is that although the pilot wave theories, like Bohm theory in particular, reject local dynamics by embracing superluminal causal influences, faster than light causal influences, and thus rejecting relativity theory, although you can do that, it also seems like there might be a different way of rejecting local dynamics, which actually isn't necessarily going to create any problems for you with relativity theory. And this I find quite interesting. So if you want to derive local dynamics, it's actually not enough to assume that causal influences travel slower than light. That does not get you all the way there. It gets you part of the way there. But you also need to assume something else, which we called separable dynamics. It's a bit abstract, but the rough idea is that dynamical processes, they've got this causal structure and they sort of separate according to their causal structure. I mean, perhaps an easier way of trying to get your head around the basic sort of intuition for it, rather than just sort of reciting the formal definition, is to think about an analogy with the non-separable states from quantum theory. So people who are somewhat familiar with quantum theory might know that in quantum theory, we've got a non-separable state space. So what does that mean? What does it mean for a state space or a state to be non-separable? What it means is that I can tell you the complete state of one particle and a complete state of another particle, but then you still don't know the whole state of the pair of particles. So somehow there's this holism. There's properties that pertain to the pair of particles that you just can't explain or you can't see when you are only looking at the individual properties of each particle, right? Somehow in quantum theory or with quantum states, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. But in quantum theory, this sense in which this kind of holism, the sense in which the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, the sense in which we've got non-separability is sort of confined to the states in the theory. Right, it's about quantum entanglement, basically. This is precisely quantum entanglement, the non-separability of the states. But in quantum theory, the unitary dynamics are separable in a sense that we sort of define explicitly in our paper. But it turns out that dynamical separability is one of those assumptions that you need in order to derive local dynamics. So one way of rejecting local dynamics and actually getting back to the absoluteness of observed events is rejecting this separability of the dynamical structure that we still find in quantum theory. Now, on the one hand, although this doesn't seem to create any necessary problems with relativity theory, this does involve rejecting unitary quantum theory, which is a very radical move. It's a move that a lot of people won't want to make. It's a very big deal. But at the same time, I kind of prefer this way of rejecting unitary quantum theory, or I prefer this way of modifying unitary quantum theory to what you do with objective collapse theories, right? Because there you're just kind of assuming that at some point there's this kind of stochastic collapse, there's this interruption to the information preserving dynamics, and you're sort of not supported by any direct experimental evidence when you do that. And it's not really suggested very naturally by the framework of quantum theory itself. But on the other hand, when it comes to non-separability, as I was kind of saying a second ago, non-separability is at the core of quantum entanglement, it's at the core of the violation of Bell inequalities, it's arguably, at least the non-separability of states is arguably already at the core of the message that quantum theory is trying to tell us. And so you could try to argue that by rejecting dynamical separability, by embracing the non-separability of dynamics, we're rejecting quantum theory, yes, but we're also somehow leaning further into its core message. And so it's kind of a way of trying to recover the absoluteness of observed events that I think is, I mean, it's not ideal because you've got to reject unitary quantum theory, but I find it kind of more attractive than most of the approaches that we've seen so far.
If I could add to clarify to that, so as Nick said, in order to, so just to maybe summarize, since there's a lot going on, right? So the first no-go theorem, as Nick said, is sort of just saying that any BIL theory is a perspectival theory, is going to lead to a version of the measurement problem where you don't have absoluteness of events. And then splitting this L assumption, locality assumption, further, you see that you have sort of this idea of relativistic causality, that you don't have causation going outside your light cone, you don't have faster than light causal influences. But then you, in addition, need this additional assumption of dynamical separability to get you this local dynamics. And so indeed, one way to preserve the absoluteness of events is to reject this dynamical separability. But indeed, that would mean giving up the unitary dynamics of quantum theory. But it doesn't mean that you give up information preservation, because while unitary dynamics is information preserving, not all information preserving dynamics is unitary. So you could still imagine that the dynamics of this theory preserves information, but nevertheless, it's not specifically described by a unitary evolution. There could be a different kind of dynamics that still preserves information. So in that sense, in principle, there's the possibility that you could keep the other assumption of Bell non-locality, information preservation, be all, you know, completely consistent with relativistic causality, but somehow, you know, slightly modify your unitary dynamics in order to give you this dynamical non-separability and thereby keep the absoluteness of events. So that's one approach. Now Nick described.
Yeah.
And to give a completely different alternative, which is sort of again relating to your question of how do we make sense of this no-go theorem, right? Like what is the sort of consequence of this? And indeed, there are a different class of approaches, which would say that on one hand, you can think of this non-absoluteness of events as being the measurement problem. It's a bad thing for your theory. But on the other hand, you could say that, well, this is somehow given that there are theories that we've shown that any theory with these natural assumptions should lead to this kind of non-absoluteness of events. You could say, well, I treat this more as a feature and not a bug. And you can kind of have a completely different research program, which also people are pursuing, which is to say that, okay, I want to keep my BIL as it is. And then our no-go theorem tells us that you have non-absoluteness of events. Now you can ask these interesting questions about if my theory does have non-absolute measurement events, then how do I do science in this theory? How do I make physical predictions? How do I reason about, you know, logically about each other's knowledge? How do I make conclusions? And how can I make sure that I can still use this theory in a consistent manner to do science, make predictions and validate them. And I also find that route very interesting because just to take some, you know, kind of going back historically, how physics developed, if we go back to like Newton's picture of physics, there was an absolute notion of space and time, you know, and this was thought of at that time as being the right way to make sense of the world. And then came along Einstein and you know, it seems that you have to like give up an absolute notion of space and time and accept that they're somehow relational or relative. And like the idea of events being simultaneous itself relative to an observer or a reference frame. And so that was a radical shift, but now Einstein's theory has been very well validated and so on. So in a similar spirit, I think it could also be a natural direction to consider, if we give up this absoluteness of events, can we still have a well-defined scientific theory that allows us to make predictions despite, quote unquote, the measurement problem? So in a sense, can we still see the measurement problem as a feature and not a bug? So in a sense, these are two major sort of research directions that could be informed by such no-code theorems. One is to, you know, keep absoluteness of events, but, you know, instead go for a feature like dynamical non-separability, or the other would be to keep dynamical separability, all the other assumptions, but maybe go for accepting that events can be non-absolute.
Okay, so in order to try to explain this, you've broken up the local dynamics into three parts, is what I heard, and we're basically sticking with relativity. We're sticking with no superluminal influences, mm-hmm. which is good. And then you're saying there's a separable dynamics. You're saying maybe that's not really quite true. That's something we can look at as something we can get rid of. And the third one in there was something called a consistent embedding, which sounds extremely mathy.
It's, sorry, go on.
No, well, I was just going to ask you to sort of explain what a consistent embedding is. And, you know, maybe we can see, is that as solid as relativity? Is that just something we need to do math? Or is that something else we can look at as something to violate?
Yeah, so I don't think it's going to be something that anyone is going to want to give up. So to give you an example of what the consistent embeddings assumption is doing, even if we're doing unitary quantum theory, actually, not in a sense, not all transformations are unitary, because if I've got a unitary transformation that's taking place, I don't know, over the whole universe, for example, but then I ignore a lot of the universe and I focus on this little bit of the universe, the transformation that's taking place on that bit of the universe alone is not necessarily unitary. In particular, if the part of the universe that I'm still looking at is really interacting with the other bit of the universe, but I'm not accounting for that, then it's not going to be unitary anymore. It's going to be a more general type of dynamical transformation that's called a quantum channel. But if we are doing unitary quantum theory, then we think all quantum channels arise from some bigger unitary transformation, right? So we got a certain non-fundamental transformations in our theory, in this case, the quantum channels, but they arise from the fundamental ones, right? They just arise when we consider bigger transformations, but then we ignore part of them. Okay. And then consistent embeddings is just talking about the way that these transformations are actually implemented, the way that they actually take place concretely within space-time. And so the idea is that if I'm implementing a quantum channel somewhere in my bedroom right now, and it's a quantum channel because actually this process is interacting with stuff that's outside of my bedroom, then that means that there is this bigger transformation, there's this unitary transformation that's being applied to my bedroom, but also the stuff outside my bedroom. But the point is that, well, in fact, that's it. I just said it. So this bigger transformation is taking place partly inside of my bedroom. Why? Because if it wasn't, then it wouldn't have given rise to a channel that's taking place inside my bedroom. So the fundamental transformation, the unitary, can be embedded in space-time in a way that is consistent with the manner in which the non-fundamental transformation, the quantum channel, is embedded in space-time. I don't really know what it would mean to reject this assumption.
Okay, so that gets us through the paper, as far as I can tell. Is there anything else that you'd like to focus on about this, or anything else you think that you know was left out?
I guess more for the discussion that we were having, right? So indeed, I think for the future directions, it gives rise to a number of different interesting directions. One was, as Nick pointed out, this idea of if you really don't want the measurement problem, or at least this version of the measurement problem, you want events to be absolute in your theory, then one can try to look into our no-go theorem and identify what are the directions, right? And it might seem like rejecting this dynamical non-separability is one, you know, somehow seems like the least of the evils if you want to keep absoluteness of events in your theory. And indeed, like while our theorem allows this as a possibility, one has to, of course, try to construct an explicit categorical probabilistic theory that has Bell-Nunn locality, information preservation, like no superluminal influences, but gives up dynamical separability, right? And constructing such a theory is an open problem that one can try to undertake. And it would be very interesting, I think, to see whether such a consistent theory with these properties can be constructed, right? And this would be quite interesting to look at on the one side. And indeed, on the other side, as I said, one can say that, okay, I'm happy to give up absoluteness of events because I prefer to hold on to all these other assumptions as more basic. And then one can try to say, okay, now again, construct a theory that gives up absoluteness of events, but still allows you to do science and make predictions in a consistent way, but preserves all these other assumptions. And that's also sort of an active program. And so we have some work in that direction of giving up absoluteness of events, but still constructing a well-defined, consistent, logically, causally consistent models doing science. But maybe Nick, if you want to add to that as well.
Yeah, so I agree. It really throws up these two sort of alternative research programs. And I think both are important. In terms of the research program that pursues non-absoluteness, that tries to make sense of a non-absolute theory. So this, despite the fact that I was sort of making a case for dynamical non-separability earlier, this is also the research program that I'm pursuing now. And I agree that this is very important. And one of the reasons I think it's important is these no-go theorems, not just ours, also the one that came before ours. For me, they make very clear a really basic and fundamental inadequacy of the quantum theory that's taught to us in textbooks. Because the quantum theory that's taught to us in textbooks typically claims that isolated systems always evolve unitarily. And that, especially if you're also going to believe in relativity theory, that really strongly pushes you towards denying absoluteness if you want to be logically consistent, right? If you want to avoid saying something stupid like 0 = 1 or something. But despite this, when you read a textbook, they still sort of, they tend to talk as if there's this kind of stable classical reality in which we can describe observed events as being absolute. So even if you were a very good student of quantum theory and, you know, you work through your great big 500 page textbook and you do all of the exercises, you could really be forgiven for thinking that observed events really are absolute. And this, for me, highlights a really basic inadequacy in our best physical theory, which is quantum theory. Yeah, I think it's good if these no-go results encourage more people to work on actually fixing this fundamental inconsistency that's at the heart of physics. And I guess maybe it would also be nice to make one other comment about this other research program with the dynamical separability. You mentioned, James, that you've talked about Bell-Nunn locality before on the podcast. And to me, something that's kind of nice about this recent result is there's sort of an analogy with one of my kind of favorite narratives about how we should respond to Bell's theorem. So the way that a lot of people think about Bell's theorem and the way that I think Bell initially thought about his result was that he was showing that there was this big, big disaster in physics, because if the quantum predictions for the Bell experiments turned out to be true, which of course they did in the end, then Bell thought that that would mean that we would have to embrace some kind of superluminal causal influences, right? But relativity theory rules out, or at least makes very difficult, the idea that there are superluminal causes. And so we were going to have to reject relativity theory, despite the fact that it's very well confirmed by other experiments. And so people worried that there was this great problem for Bell's theorem, that we're going to have to embrace these superluminal influences, even though we don't want to. Either do that or just give up on the idea that we should explain correlations, but that also feels pretty unsatisfactory. But then there was this alternative response to Bell's theorem, which developed through the work of initially Jarrett and Shimony, and then there were these nice philosophical papers towards the end of the 1980s, where people said, hang on, is true that the violation of Bell inequalities pushes us very hard to accept some kind of non-locality in nature. That's true. But we should be very careful here. We should be very precise with our words and the concepts we mean by our words. There's more than one type of non-locality you can consider, said these people. One type of non-locality is causal influences going faster than the speed of light. And yeah, that's probably ruled out by relativity theory. But another kind of non-locality is this kind of holism that I was talking about earlier, this kind of non-separability, the idea that a pair of particles can have properties that just cannot be understood in terms of the individual properties of each member of the pair. This is a sort of a non-locality of properties, if you like. It's an ontological locality rather than a non-locality of influences or a dynamical non-locality. People often make this nice distinction between action at a distance, which was the dynamical sort of non-locality, and passion at a distance, which was this more sort of holistic feature. To me, what this recent result, though, about the measurement problem shows is that we can sort of maybe tell a similar story about how we should respond to the measurement problem. So if we just assume for a minute that we do really want to hang on to the absoluteness of observed events, and we also assume for whatever reason that we want to maintain information preservation, then our result essentially tells us that we're going to have to give up on local dynamics. We're going to have to accept some form of dynamical non-locality. Now, you might intuitively think that non-locality of dynamics means that we're going to have to accept these causal influences traveling faster than light, and we're going to have to reject relativity theory. And you might feel that that's a pretty painful thing to do. But again, it turns out that we can make a distinction. Before, we were distinguishing between sort of non-locality of dynamics and non-locality of states or something like that. That's what we were doing with Bell's theorem. But now, even within dynamical non-locality, we can make a more fine-grained distinction between two different types of dynamical non-locality. And one type of dynamical non-locality is the one that we don't want, which is these superluminal influences. But the other one is this idea that dynamics are non-separable, as I described earlier. And so it seems to me that one of the cute things about this result is it suggests this analogy between the way we might respond to Bell and the way we might respond to the measurement problem. With Bell, we want to occupy that sweet spot, having non-locality without non-local causation in the form of non-separable states. With the measurement problem, again, we want to occupy this kind of sweet spot between having no non-locality and having causal non-locality by embracing the idea of dynamics that don't separate into smaller dynamical transformations.
Yeah. So if I could add to the point about sort of connecting to how we respond to Bell experiments, right? And maybe it should be fair to mention sort of these previous no-go theorems, which are really, like in the case of Bell scenarios, right? Like you have, as you mentioned, James, you have these CHSH inequalities that we've now observed that we can violate in experiments. So the original Bell's theorem sort of tells us that, okay, there are these set of assumptions which are inconsistent with the idea of local causality or with Bell non-locality. And since we have now observed Bell non-locality in the sense that, or violation of local causality by violating these inequalities, then we are forced to give up one of these assumptions. In a similar way, one can, like these previous no-go theorems that came before us, have actually derived these kind of inequalities, which under maybe a slightly different set of assumptions, which show that if your theory satisfies absoluteness of events, you will also satisfy these inequalities. So which means that if a future experiment is able to violate one of these inequalities, then you show that, in fact, your theory has non-absoluteness of events insofar as you could perform these experiments. And of course, these are not something we can do with current technologies, but indeed, there is a research program trying to understand how one might perform these experiments. And I would say that while all these no-go theorems, they kind of, give us interesting perspectives on which direction we might go and so on. We can have these interesting discussions. Of course, ultimately, one would have to look to experiments and see what kind of data you observe and what that tells you about which assumption to give up, right? So if it so happens that we are able to violate one of these inequalities, in a reasonable way, in a loophole-free way, in some rather maybe far future experiment, then we would have to conclude that our theory doesn't have absoluteness of events in the same way that we had to conclude in light of violations of Bell inequalities that we don't have local causality or we don't have a description in terms of a local hidden variable model. And then one would then have to construct now a new theory that doesn't have this property, for instance. And maybe to add to Nick's comment about this program of sort of giving up absoluteness of events, it's indeed absolutely right that textbook version of quantum theory is at least inadequate for telling us how to handle these sort of big nurse friend type scenarios, right? It seems to suggest that somehow you do have absoluteness of events. That's because if you sort of look at it more carefully, textbook quantum theory is somehow implicitly assuming that you put all observers outside the Heisenberg cut. Somehow you apply textbook quantum theory to the systems like electrons and photons and whatever that you describe quantum mechanically, but I'm not going to apply textbook quantum theory to Nick or to you, James. Like this is sort of implicitly assumed that we only apply it to things that we regard as small enough to be quantum in some sense, right? And I would say that indeed, a lot of these previous no-code theorems are suggesting that perhaps there's some fundamental inconsistency with applying quantum theory to observers, and like a big pathology and logical paradoxes that would arise if you do so. But this is indeed, when you sort of naively look at textbook quantum theory, this seems like this would be the case. But in fact, now we have some recent work which shows that if you look at it a bit more carefully and this implicit assumption of sort of modeling all agents as outside the Heisenberg cut and try to relax it a bit, one can actually extend quantum theory in a perfectly consistent way to include observers and still be consistent. Of course, this doesn't solve the problem, but I think it's a nice initial result that shows that it's not that quantum theory is fundamentally inconsistent or has an issue, even if you apply it to these Wigner-Friend type scenarios where you don't have absoluteness of events. It actually does, if you look at it carefully and analyze the implicit assumptions we have when we write down textbook version of quantum theory. It does itself, quantum theory does itself provide you with a way to kind of reason in a logically consistent manner and make physical predictions when we go to these more general scenarios. So I still feel positive that this research program of giving up absoluteness of events can succeed, and even in a scenario where we believe in unitary quantum theory. But I think I would say ultimately, of course, you know, it's the experiments that decide. It's important to pursue all these different directions in the same way that even for Bell's theorem, one can look at now, we have very nice different models that give up one assumption and not the other, for instance. And it's important to pursue like all these different directions.
Okay, excellent. Excellent. That's great. I think that's got everything. And so I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
For the questions and for having us.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers episode number 75, Categorical Probability Theory and the Measurement Problem, with Nick Ormrod and V. Velocini. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/75. Show notes include the paper I read for this podcast, as well as related episodes to Physics Frontiers, related papers, and really anything else I think of while I'm putting the webpage together. So it's been maybe about 2 years or so since I mentioned the Patreon here, so maybe it's about time to ask again. But yes, we have a Patreon. It's at patreon.com/physicsfrontiers. And if you like the program, and I'm assuming you do if you're listening to me still talk, then, you know, I would ask if you might help out a little bit with the cost of the program, right? It's not extremely expensive, but it's not insignificant. I don't know if that makes any sense. So it's not going to be critical, but I'll smooth things over with my wife a little bit. Anyways, thank you very much for listening once again, and I'll see you next time, which will be just as awesome. All right, so bye now.